Caregivers, have you ever felt like nothing is going right? Well, cheer up and welcome to Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Program, where you'll learn how to avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout and how to survive the grieving process. Join Dave and his guests now as they share practice tips and tools that you can start using immediately to help get you through this day. Now, here's your caregiver host, Dave Nassani.
Well, I usually say from Los Angeles, but now I have to say from Waikiki Beach, Hawaii. A big aloha. Welcome to all my listeners out there in Radio Land. I'm Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver, coming to you live and on demand 24/7 on 14 global platforms, including iTunes and YouTube and Spreaker and SoundCloud and Vimeo, and the list goes on. And also on CaregiverDave.com, voted the number 2 best caregiving podcast of 2017. And we are sure proud of that. We have an exciting interview planned for you today with my lovely co-host, Adrian Gruberg from the caregiver space. Unfortunately, Adrian's not here today. I think there was a misunderstanding and it was probably my fault. But we will be interviewing today author Janet Fouts. Is a mindfulness coach, not a mindless coach, a mindfulness coach working with people to improve self-awareness and be happier in their lives and at home and at work. So let's get started. But before we do that, I want to take this moment to thank my last week's guest, Christina Ashley, author of her new book, All Was Love. And that was an amazing, and it still is an amazing book. I recommend everybody go and read that. And you can hear that show and all our shows on our membership website, caregiverdave.com, or on any of those other networks that I mentioned earlier, you know, iTunes, YouTube, SoundCloud, Blog Talk Radio, all of that. All right, enough of that. Hey, big welcome to my guest, Janet Fouts. Her journey as a caregiver inspired the transition from a well-respected social media marketer and CEO to a mindfulness coach. After discovering the value of mindfulness, at rescuing her from depression and anxiety, she shares her learnings in her book, When Life Hits the Fan. And I think we all know what IT stands for. A mindful coach to caring for ourselves while caring for others. In other words, a caregiver. Now available on Amazon. So welcome to the show, Janet. So excited to have you here.
It took us
a little bit of technical difficulty. We started a little late, but you know, that's okay. Better late than never, and the show must go on.
So they
say. Why don't you take a minute? Yes. Why don't you take a minute or two and introduce yourself? I like to ask my guests just who is Janet Fouts and why was she put on this earth?
Oh my gosh. I've worn an awful lot of hats in my life. I have been a horse trainer and a chef. I've done a lot of different things.
Horse trader or trainer?
Trainer.
Oh.
And over the last 20 years, I've been an entrepreneur working in digital marketing and social media. And then, you know, when life hit the fan, I really found myself deep in caregiving and found that I was totally unprepared for this. And I'm sure that your listeners can relate to that.
Yeah, it just wasn't on your resume, was it?
Was not prepared.
Wow. Well, that's what we talk about. You know, I wasn't prepared. I don't think anybody is really prepared. So that's why I try to get people prepared. And I try to say to everybody, you know, if you're not a caregiver, you should still be listening because you're either going to become one, you're going to need one. There's no escaping it. Caregiving will touch your life at some point, probably sooner rather than later, because the baby boomers are getting older and older and needing care, Alzheimer's, dementia. I mean, you name it. They're getting it, and there's a shortage of caregivers, and there's a shortage of facilities, and what few caregivers we have left, they're killing themselves. 30% are dying before their loved one, and 60% are becoming hospitalized, needing a caregiver of their own, getting sicker than their loved one. How did you first get into caregiving? I mean, you obviously it hit you unexpectedly. What were the circumstances surrounding that?
Well, actually, the first time that I was involved in a caregiving situation was with my parents. My mother had congestive heart failure. My father had Alzheimer's. We all expected my dad to go first, and my mother went first. And that made it really difficult. And unfortunately, at the time, I was younger, I was less responsible, and I really handed it off to my sister to manage. And, you know, I would show up periodically, and I loved my parents. I would come and visit, but I was not a caregiver. And now I look back on it and kick myself and thank my sister repeatedly for having been kind of lame about the whole thing.
Oh, my. And that's so brave of you to admit that, because you're the person that all these caregivers that are on my Facebook page, 35,000, complain about. You know, I've got five brothers and five sisters, and, you know, none of them come around. I got no help. And look it, here you are, and at least you're showing remorse.
Oh, much remorse. And actually, you know, in talking to the caregivers I interviewed for the book, I really understand now a couple of things. And I'm not blaming my sister. I'm not taking anything off myself. But one of the things we do as caregivers, and I did this when I became a caregiver for real this time, you figure you're the only one that can do it. You figure that you got to be the one because nobody else knows what's going on.
Right.
You actually push people away and try to do it all yourselves, which isn't helping you, and it's not helping the person you're caring for.
Yeah.
And I realize that now, having done that too, because I've been both sides now, yeah. Been the lame caregiver and the totally obsessed caregiver.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And, you know, we can't be too hard on the siblings because, like you said, you know, they're just, they don't know what they don't know. And until it happens and until there's no one else around, until, you know, you are the only one who steps up to the bat, or maybe you're the one that the parent feels the most comfortable with, because a parent knows who she wants to be their caregiver and who of their children and who they don't. Let's say there's somebody else who has five children, and you know, they're having this conversation, which I recommend you have these conversations before,
yes,
dementia hits, before you fall down and break that hip. You know, you make out an advance directive so that you are clear and your kids are clear on under what circumstances do you want the plug pulled. And, you know, is it for a feeding tube being put down your throat? Is it for a ventilator? Is it for, you know, the paddles to revive you? You know, it has to do with a lot of things, you know, your quality of life, how long you had a great quality of life, and if you feel like you've lived life to its fullness, and I kind of have, although I'm getting a renaissance of my life now. So a couple of years ago, I was of a different attitude. You know, let's just, if it's time, I'm ready. But now I'm not sure. But now, you've been caring for your partner for how long?
Yeah, so for the last 12 years, I've been caring for my partner who has breast cancer. And she was diagnosed and all of a sudden in surgery within days.
Oh my.
And it totally took us off guard. We did not have any advanced directives. We didn't have any of that stuff together. And we were really thrust into it. And both of us are fixers, which makes things really interesting, because we both immediately went into, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to fix this? What are we going to do about this and that? And frenetic activity to try to figure out how to manage this.
Oh.
And it was pretty intense.
So this was a 12-year partner?
Yeah, she's still here. She's doing very well. But it's been a really wild and crazy ride.
Yeah, and how old are you guys?
I'm going to be 60 in January. She's 55.
Yeah, because I often ask myself, you know, if that happens to me, you know, I'm not sure I would do the chemo route and go through all that. I've seen so many people suffer and you know, take this poison in you. And I interviewed Suzanne Summers at Harvard, and she had breast cancer. And, you know, she's a natural guru of healing and alternative medicine and interactive medicine. And so she told her doctors, I'm not going to get chemo. And he says, well, what are you going to do? She says, I'm going to go to Mexico and I'm going to do it through food, exercise and diet.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, but you have, I think it was stage four. He says, I don't care. And so 20 years she's been cancer free. I believe she removed a breast. And through natural hormones, she claims that she grew it back. She says,
wow,
she's the only one she knows of who has grown back a breast. So I would recommend, I don't know where your friend is in the process. Where is she in the process? What has she done? What hasn't she done? What's she willing to do?
You're always in limbo. I mean, chemo is absolutely horrendous on the body. And honestly, I wouldn't do it, having been through it and several rounds of it over the years. It does horrendous things to the body, mentally. Everything just kind of falls apart. And we're literally pumping poison into our bodies. And, you know, I think at some point we're going to look at chemo as bloodletting, that it's just as archaic as that.
I think so. There's a lot of cutting edge things on the horizon, or actually in use now. You know, there were I had a cousin who had she had injections. This was at Stanford University, of the cancer, and so that the antibodies would attack it, and then they would take that those healthy cells that are attacking, and inject her with that. And she's been cancer-free for about 20 years as well. So there's a lot of different stuff going on right now. And you just have to keep up with it. But
there
I don't know if I would do the bloodletting, or in the Civil War when you had a bullet in your arm, they would just cut off your arm. You know, it does seem archaic. So what are the biggest strategies? We were just getting started as a couple. I mean, you two. And what was your struggles, I should say, not your strategies?
Well, you know, initially it was that we had just moved into our first home together. You know, we had a young son who was just going to his first preschool when we found out that she got cancer. And it was really devastating. You know, dealing with the medical system, the way that the medical system treated her and treated me in particular as a caregiver, I was pretty darn angry for a very long time. And, you know, it's interesting because as you go through cycles of caregiving, you start out by wanting to fix everything and you use up all that energy. And what was interesting to me was that when they declared that she was cancer free, I had been doing it for so long that I kind of went into a huge fit of depression. I went into depression when she got diagnosed. And then I kind of worked out of it because I was going so hard and, you know, running and running and trying to fix things. And then I crashed.
And why do you think that is? What was the depression about afterwards?
It felt really awful to be depressed that she was better. It's just horrible. But it was really having a lack of any real purpose to do something that I felt, you know, as long as I was taking care of her, I was saving her. And of course, I wasn't, but it felt that way.
You know, and Janet, what you're going through is very common. And it's called when you're no longer a caregiver. A lot of people, it's almost like being in prison, being institutionalized, and then you get out. You know, you might be a big man in prison. You know, you're the guy who everybody gets cigarettes from, and I can get you anything you want. And, you know, he's wheeling and dealing, and he's got people protecting him, and he's a big shot. Mm-hmm. He gets out, and he's just a bum, you know. And that happens with caregivers. They become so focused on their mission. Mm-hmm. You know, they're so important, and all of a sudden they're not needed anymore. And a lot of people do go into depression. And what I recommend with those people is start volunteering. Go to the senior center. Go to nursing homes, because you are needed if that's what you're going through. On the other hand, some people, hallelujah, I'm free. I'm out of prison, you know. And they just start living life again. And you know, you can't criticize one or the other. It's just the way you're made up. So how did you get through that depression? How long did it take?
Took me about 2 or 3 years, really. Well, let's say 2 years. And what I did was I started going back to some mindfulness practices that I had done before, Tai Chi in particular, that made me feel better. And then I went to a mindfulness-based stress reduction course to really understand, you know, what was going on. And that just blew me away, because it really helped me understand what was going on in my mind, and also the physiological reasons that we respond the way we do. You know, when our amygdala goes off in our brain and it puts us in fight or flight mode, we can actually stop that by just recognizing it and changing the way that we approach things or reframing things. That just blew my mind. That here I thought everything was in my head, and okay, it was in my brain, so I guess it was. But, you know, it really amazed me how little I knew about why everything was happening the way it was. And once I realized that, then I really started studying.
So what if somebody, a friend, came up to you when you just entered this 2-year period of depression and tried to tell you what I just told you? You know, why don't you volunteer? Why don't you? Were you in a place to receive that kind of counsel?
No.
Or would have been just in one ear, out the other?
You know, when we're depressed at that level, you know, at one point I was suicidal. I just was going to give it up. I was done, which is really crazy. Okay, she's better. Oh, I'm going to kill myself. Does that make any sense? No. But you don't always make sense. And I don't think I could have heard it then. I had to find it for myself. But it is why I wrote this book, because I want to tell people, you don't have to be like this. I don't want anybody to go through the cycles that I went through without having some tools to really help them. So that's kind of been my way of going back into service and to help caregivers.
So you think someone who is in your state of mind, who's reading your book, it might get through?
I hope so. I hope that the stories that aren't just my story, that, you know, people can relate to what other caregivers have gone through and read their stories and recognize something of themselves.
Yeah. Is this background noise distracting? I'm hearing the surf, hearing children, and I'm hearing a helicopter. Are we okay?
I don't hear it at all.
Okay.
The surf would be nice, though. Just open the window a bit.
The surf is nice. So, yeah, I try to put myself on the balcony, but it's so bright behind me that there just wasn't enough light in front of me. It would only work at sundown, but then that would be midnight for Adrian, so we can't do that. Well, listen, we are coming up on a break, so let me take a break, a short break, and we will be right back. So don't go away. One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships is about Charlene, a stroke survivor. Back in 1996, Charlene was a healthy, normal, very active 52-year-old woman whose amazing talents resemble that of both a Martha Stewart and a Wonder Woman. But all that changed when she suffered a massive stroke that left her severely speech impaired and paralyzed on the right side. Who am I? My name is David. I've had the privilege of being Charlene's husband since 1975. We had a wonderful, fairy tale, storybook-like courtship that culminated in our marriage a year later. Charlene had just come out of a marriage where, after 10 years, she received 2 black eyes and a broken nose by her former husband when he came home high on speed. Charlene believed in no second chances of any kind for abuse, so she left. Finding herself all alone in the world with her 5 and 10-year-old daughters, Cynthia Lorraine and Deborah Lynn, she started raising them by herself for the next 2 years. Then fate brought us all together. After falling in love with Charlene, Cindy, and Debbie, our love then produced Rebecca Elizabeth. We had a wonderful, normal life for the next 20 years. But today, things are very different for everyone. One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships is the amazing story of a woman's fight to survive all that life had thrown her way. Everyone who knows Charlene is thoroughly amazed at how she lives day by day, month by month, year by year, and with a smile on her face and hope in her heart that everything is going to be okay. Her faith in God is her foundation in this hope, that everything happens for a reason, and what doesn't kill her will make her stronger. She inspires everyone who meets her. Her accomplishments since her stroke are very impressive, often making us normal people look like whiners and complainers. So pick up your copy of One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships today. You won't be disappointed. Just hear what best-selling author Lynn Barrington has to say about it. If you think you have it bad, read this book. This is a beautiful, genuine story told from the heart. It's inspiring and easy to read. When you finish this book, you'll be able to look at your concerns in a new light. How about the reaction of 9-time Grammy and Dove Award recipient, the godfather of contemporary gospel Christian music, Andre Crouch? Charlene just won't let the promises of God go, and she has not let her circumstances get in the way of her faith. She's not just a survivor, she's more than a conqueror, as the Bible states. You'll be encouraged by her testimony, regardless of what you're going through. Available everywhere, but if you purchase your copy directly from the author's website, onearmoneleg100words.com, Charlene and David will personally autograph your copy. Enjoy! And we're back with Janet Faust. Am I saying that right?
Faust.
Close enough. And Dave Nassani, the caregiver's caregiver. So we're just talking about how Janet became a caregiver to her partner and what were the strategies, you know, when they found out, and how she entered into depression when her partner started getting better, which sounds illogical, doesn't it? So what mistakes did you make as a caregiver? Lord knows I've made every mistake possible. And that's why I'm able to, you know, do a radio show. I have a membership website. I've written a best-selling book. And there's just something inside of me that doesn't want other people to make the same mistakes I made with my wife. You know, my wife had a stroke, lost her speech 22 years ago, paralyzed on the right side, and she still can't talk after 22 years, but she can communicate non-verbally through Pictionary charades, two games I hate, by the way, but I'm learning to love. And she's got this power wheelchair that goes faster than me, and we travel all around the world. We're both here in Hawaii. I'm speaking at 7 events, and she likes to come to the fun places, you know, like New York, Florida, where we have relatives and stuff, Hawaii, but she doesn't like to go to Des Moines, Iowa. And I'm so sorry, Des Moines, I feel so bad when I say that, because I have a good friend over there, a caregiver friend in Des Moines. But I liked it. So tell me about your mistakes. Did you make any?
Oh, my gosh. It's so endless. So endless. You know, the first mistake, though, and the biggest mistake, I think, was trying to do too much and do it all by myself. You know, going into overdrive mode and staying there. Not only did my family and friends suffer from that, obviously, so did my partner, and so did work. So, you know, it impacted on a lot of different levels. When we go into overdrive like that, we know we can only do it for so long. I have a tendency to stop listening. I don't want to listen to the doctors, just get stuff done. There was one incident where right in the middle of chemo, she had an appendicitis attack, and we ended up in the emergency room. And the weird thing about chemo is that nobody wants to touch you. All the doctors are afraid to wait until the oncologist says, oh, yeah, you can give her this drug. Or, you know, they're worried about drug interactions. You're toxic. I think they're afraid they're going to kill you. So they really freak out. And
let me interject a question there.
Yes.
Do they give you probiotics during the chemo? And if they don't, that just doesn't make any sense at all. I have heard that there's a probiotic that people have been using for thousands of years, and it's practically cheap. It's the raw sauerkraut that you can find at Whole Foods, mm-hmm. and just take a tablespoon a day, and it's got billions and billions of healthy bacteria versus like yogurt that only has millions. So do they tell you to
no?
And why
no,
is
no,
that?
No, 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 no. We went to we believe in naturopathy, and we went to the nutritionist. And they literally told us no raw vegetables, no probiotics, because it would mess up your system. They said because your white count could drop because of the chemo, and then it would be a concern. It was never a concern. And she was aggressive
They think
treatment.
It's going to save the bad cells as opposed to – I would think it would increase the good. It's the healthy bacteria.
Well, you would think that. But I will tell
the
you,
cancer
cells. We did have an instance where – because we did obviously use yogurt and lots of other things naturopathic remedies, and one of them was yogurt. And at one point, she was taking probiotics, and her intestines basically got too much probiotics, and there was a flowering of all of the little critters that feed on that, and it caused a pretty major gastrointestinal crisis.
It was bad. You don't recommend it.
It was bad.
So they were right.
But that doesn't mean that we don't continue to do it. We're just a little more careful with quantities and different things. But drug interactions are a really big deal with chemo because they don't really know what this stuff does. And especially when you're in a trial, they don't always know what's going to interact with it or cause a problem.
Yeah.
So you got to be careful about those things. But we did find an oncologist at San Francisco State who understood what our issues were and helped us out a lot with some of that.
So let's talk about that 2-year, I guess it's a grieving period. Depression is part of grief, you know, with all the suicides in the news lately, you know, the latest being Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain. You know, whenever there's depression, we always must ask, is suicide far behind? And AARP did a study of 1,677 caregivers and found that roughly half of them felt down, depressed, and hopeless just within the past 2 weeks of the study. I assume those are three things that you felt. How did it affect your job? I mean, were they about to fire you, or were you functioning at work? I mean, what were the things that were causing your life to go into chaos outside of your depression for that 2 years?
Well, some of the things that happened were simply being inattentive. Being burned out and fried keeps me from being on top of it. And in my business, you got to be really fast because, you know, I work in digital marketing and social media. So you're moving pretty quickly. And I'm really very, very grateful for having a wonderful team that put up with me and put up with me screaming at them because they didn't do something that I didn't tell them to do because I was not really present. I did lose clients and I stopped really looking for work for quite a bit of time where I was just floating by and really not caring whether I had clients or business or not. So that was the work effect of it. As far as my personal life, you know, I did the usual stuff you do when you're depressed. I started drinking.
Self-medicating.
Yeah, lots of self-medication. I went to a therapist, and she listened to me pour out all my woes and basically said, oh, well, you need to be medicated. I don't like drugs, and I really didn't respond well to them. I kind of freaked out about it, and that's, you know, again, what sent me to MBSR. It sent me to going to the Center for Compassion at Stanford and spending time there. And like I do with a lot of things, like I did with cancer, I started digging in and really studying and learning from some of the people that I really respect, like Pema Chodron, who's a wonderful author on Buddhism. And I'm not a Buddhist, but I don't play one on TV either. But I do really appreciate some of the theories that Pema Chodron and others have come up with that really lead to mindfulness.
That's interesting. So what is an MSR course?
It's MBSR. It's Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction.
And that's something you invented?
No, it was invented by this guy, Jon Kabat-Zinn. And he was at MIT at the time, and it was really used to manage pain, people who were dealing with huge quantities of pain. One quick story from one of his books was that this process helps you deal with your pain. And there was a guy that came in with a wheelchair. He was in incredible pain, couldn't walk over a period of time, and it was the pain that he couldn't, that kept him from walking. And over a period of time, the next week he came in and he was on crutches. The following week he came in and he had a cane. And at the end of the program, he was able to walk. He still had the pain, but he knew how to manage it now. So it isn't a cure. It's a different perception of what's going on.
Did it work for you?
It worked tremendously for me.
Really?
Yeah, really understanding what was going on in my head, understanding ways to stop my brain from running off with itself, which happens quite often. just that ability to settle and really feel that I'm grounded and present where I am.
What did you mean when you said you don't play a Buddhist on TV? Was that just a joke?
That's a joke.
Okay. I just, yeah. Did I miss something in her bio that she's on TV? But you know what? You can be on TV. I can hook you up with somebody who, because I assume you're on your book tour now, right?
I am.
See, you should be on television, so I'll get you on TV.
You do that.
Okay.
You.
So, it's in your book, I assume, this what you just talked about, discovering how mindfulness can help. Mindfulness, that's a great word. You don't hear that word very often. You hear mindless a lot, but
yes.
Can someone determine how they can do that also? Is there enough details in your book about that?
There is. I give practices in the book, and I made them very, very approachable. A lot of people are turned off by mindfulness and meditation in particular because they think that maybe it's Buddhist, maybe it's something right. other, maybe
Christians,
it's really hard.
Christians are turned off by the words. You know, there's certain keywords to the metaphysical community, and I used to be into all of that metaphysical stuff, numerology, mm-hmm. meditation, transcendental meditation, astrology, Silva mind control, all of that stuff. And then I became a Christian and realized, you know, Christians believe that a lot of that stuff is like of the devil and, you know, so we're probably turning off half of the audience right now.
Well, but I need to speak to that because
yes.
when you pray, you're meditating.
Yeah.
And really,
the word meditation is in the Bible.
Yes.
Meditate on the word. You know?
Yeah. And that's why we use the term mindfulness, because it is secular. It isn't related to a religion. It's related to paying attention. And am I really listening right now? Or am I waiting for you to figure out what you're going to say and what my answer is going to be? You know, you get lost in that loop, you're not listening, you're not here, you're not present, you're not mindful. And when we are mindful, all of a sudden, you know, the biggest thing people told me was, I don't have time for this. This is going to take more time. No, you can breathe. You have to breathe. You can do that by choice. You can make choices in your day that I'm going to take 30 seconds right now. I'm a huge fan of Dr. Rick Hansen, who wrote a book called Hardwiring Happiness. And his book is really about how no matter how dark we are right now, we can find ways to find happiness as long as we allow ourselves to do that. And when we're mindful, we can see that, oh, wow, I'm in a pit again. I need to figure out how I'm going to get out of here.
And so I just had a guest on a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Antoine Chevalier, and he is very similar to Dr. Daniel Amen, and they're doing incredible studies in the brain. I mean, someone with depression or anxiety or learning disability or ADD, ADHD, with one 30-minute or one-hour session, it's crudely interpreted as acupuncture for the brain electronically, and he's been having amazing success, you know, with football players with traumatic brain injury, and even in the prisons, you know, just changing behavior, because our prison system doesn't rehabilitate, but it's all in the brain. And I think Dr. Amen's book is called Heal the Brain, Change the World, or something like that. But it's all how we interpret things. And so that's a lot of the stuff is going on right now, and we don't even realize that it's all up here, you know. So you're right on track.
Yeah, it's fascinating what you can see, the work that Daniel Goleman's doing. There are a lot of people that are really doing a lot of really interesting research right now.
Well, so let's talk about your book. What is in there that will help a person, a caregiver? Yeah, it's not only for caregivers, right? It's for everyone gets burned out.
Well, here's the thing. We are all caregivers. If
That's
somebody
true.
Trips and they have a little boo-boo, we're caregivers. And whether we're in the moment with that child at that moment or not makes a huge difference to them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what I did in the book is I didn't want it to be all about my experience because that's pretty limited, to be honest. So I interviewed, I think I'm up to about 75 people right now
Wow.
that I've interviewed. And quite honestly, anytime I mention the book, someone has a story to tell me. As you know, we're all caregivers or have a
Yep.
caregiver experience. So
Yeah.
I interviewed people in the book to find out what their challenges were and to give some tools that they could use to maybe approach it a little differently. And, you know, it may not solve their solution, but if you read it and you resonate with that story, it may help you. So I give practices in the book and also on the website that people can use.
Now, every challenge is different for a person, obviously, but what's the common theme of all the challenges that they have if you were to put it in one category?
Oh, it's definitely feeling like we are all saviors and that no one else can do it but us.
A spirit of perfectionism, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whether we know what we're doing or not,
yeah.
Which is kind of sometimes really scary.
And a lot of that comes from childhood, you know, from a parent who maybe wasn't as uplifting as they should have been, always criticizing, saying, no, you're not doing it right. You're not doing it good enough, you know. And so many kids are trying to get that affirmation from their parents that, you know, I am good enough, you know. Even when speakers go out, and I had problems with this, just, you know, why, who would come out to listen to me speak, you know, or writing the book? Who would read my book, you know? Who am I, you know, the who am I is. And that all comes from not feeling like you're worthy, not feeling that you're good enough. And that was planted in our brain a long time ago, wasn't it? How did you get that out?
You know, they call that imposter syndrome.
Imposter, yeah.
And
I hope they don't find out that I'm an imposter, right?
Well, it's really true. And a lot of the people who, you know, have imposter syndrome are highly successful. And it's because they are so driven to succeed and they have very high standards and no one can ever meet them, including them.
Yeah.
And I agree that that probably goes back to childhood. But if you can see it in yourself, then you can work with it. And that's really absolutely key with almost anything. You have to see that you're doing it and believe it before you can find ways to work around it.
How did you finally come out of the depression? What was it, or what book or what person told you something that you were able to start saying, hey, I've got to change? What was the catalyst?
I think the catalyst was honestly the therapist, and not in a way that was probably something she'd be pleased about, as I went, oh, to hell with this. And I took it upon myself to pick myself up and put my big girl shorts on and make it work. And so that's basically what I did. And then I started studying, and, you know, I'm a lifelong learner. I love to learn things. So when I found something that not only could I learn that could help me but help others, yeah, that was a no-brainer, and I really dove into it, and I'm still learning. I'll never stop.
So wait a minute. What you're saying is all you did was pick yourself up, wipe yourself off, and start all over again. Is that what
yeah,
I'm hearing?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty
Gosh,
much.
Is it really that simple?
It is, but you have to let yourself, and a lot of times we don't. Oh, I can't fix this. I'm going to be like this forever. Oh, it's so miserable. I'm so sorry for myself. Yeah, I was there, and I'm not anymore.
Wow, so many caregivers are there. And tell me if I'm right, I have come to the conclusion, now this isn't a scientific study, it's just me, I have come to the conclusion, because like I said, I've got 35,500 people on my Facebook page, and I've heard enough stories that I have figured out that a third of caregivers, one third, okay, yes, one third of them die, but the ones that die are the serious problem people. 60% get sicker. That means only 10% are healthy. So I have discovered, and I've come to the conclusion, that 30% of caregivers I won't be able to help because they have a mentality about them. And I've gotten in arguments with them, not on purpose, but you know, they're attacking me because I challenge them to, you know, caregiving can be fun. You know, it's just about attitude and how you look at it, and you look for those opportunities.
Oh no, you're wrong. You're so wrong. You're so wrong. You're just wrong.
Right. I don't understand.
I get that a lot too.
You know, because they're consumed with the problem. They're consumed with the prison sentence. They're consumed that, you know, that their loved one doesn't appreciate them. They're consumed with, you know, there's not enough money to pay the bills. They're consumed that their siblings don't give them any help, that they are the only ones. They have this perfectionist mentality. But you know what? If them and I traded places, I would see opportunities to get help by pitching it properly, right? We're all salesmen. We're all selling something, right? And if you're just trying to hit people over the head, say, buy my widget, you know, it's good for you, you're not going to sell it. But if you just cleverly, you know, put the pitch in, you know, what's in it for me? Well, hey, you know what? I build websites, and if you, maybe we can barter. If you could help me out by taking care of grandma on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for just 2 hours, so I have time to go relax, go watch a movie with a friend, go get my nails done, go to Starbucks, just feel like I'm free for 2 hours, then I will slowly build you a website. It's a win for him. It's a win for me. And so there are creative ways of getting help. There are creative ways of finding funds. You know, one of my people I interviewed, Camille Superson, wrote this thick book on how to get free stuff, you know, free food, free government assistance. But, you know, you're so consumed with poor me, that you don't bother even thinking that there is help available, that there is. So the world says, I will believe it when I see it. But, you know, the spiritual message is, no, you will see it when you believe it. And so that's the problem. Do you believe that there is about a third of caregivers, and not only caregivers, there's a third of the population, that it doesn't matter what you do, you know, they know, they don't know what I, because I usually say this book is for people, the book I wrote, for people who know they should be putting their needs first. They know they should be asking help, but they just don't know how. I can help them. It's the people who don't think it's possible that there's any hope for them. They don't think it's possible that they can convince anyone to help them. Do you agree?
I agree and I disagree, because I think that if we can just break that fixation, if we can stop and just look for one moment at where we are and how miserable we're making ourselves and others around us, we may be able to find a way out to change that. But it really takes a pretty solid kick in the butt, you know, when you're in that point. And, you know, the thing is that the reason so many caregivers die and are unwell isn't just because of, you know, the fact that they're caregivers. It's that they aren't going to the doctor. They're not filling their prescriptions because they don't have the money to do it. In the book, I have a story of a woman who was taking care of her grandmother, and she twisted her ankle, she thought. And it wasn't until her sister, who was a nurse, came and saw her and went, oh, my God, you got to go to the hospital. This is really bad. We do that all the time. And it's self-abuse, and we need to recognize that.
Yeah. Melissa, we're up on another break. So when we come back, think about your final thoughts of what you want people to take home with them, okay?
Great.
Welcome, caregivers.
Thank you so much for finding your way to our community of loving and supportive caregivers. We as caregivers understand and know the day-to-day feelings of guilt, fear, and loneliness. But guess what? There is hope. I, Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver, along with my team of experts and caring caregivers, have made this site just for you. We are a community of caregivers that understands and supports you wherever you are in your journey. We are a place to connect with other caregivers, but more importantly, a place to get practical, actionable help. There are lots of ways for you to get support. First of all, you can download our welcome pack. This will get you started on your Thrive journey. Next, you can ask and get answers to your questions by posting them here in our private Facebook groups. You can also get live online support by attending one of our live weekly Connect webinars. You can get practical, actionable advice by listening to our weekly podcast. You can hear and read other stories about other caregivers' experiences. Plus, add your own in our weekly Share Your Story forum, posted every Tuesday in the Facebook group. You can access essential resources and download practical Thrive Solutions packs, all of which are geared to help you thrive as a caregiver. We know funds are tight, so we offer all of our individual Thrive Solutions packs. Or for even a better deal, you can get lifetime access to all of our resources for a one-time fee. Again, we are here to support you and help you thrive and to enjoy your life as a caregiver. And remember, this is a place to get hope, not just cope.
And we're back with Janet Fouts and Dave Nassani, the Caregiver's Caregiver. So, Janet, we're in the final stretch here. What do you want your listeners to take home from your talk or your book? Go ahead.
What I really want people to do is read the book and the stories of other caregivers and see if they see themselves at all. And then read how we give them tools to deal with the situations that they were up against. Because unless you really read it and recognize what's going on and how it really, ooh, I do that too. We need that push to really think about what we're doing, because every caregiver I spoke to was so deep in it that they weren't picking up books. They weren't looking for ways to fix themselves. They were looking for ways to, quote unquote, survive. And some of them did and some of them didn't. So we really need to take this as an opportunity and spend 5 minutes, just 5 minutes, reading a book rather than worrying, because all that worrying you're doing is not helping you.
Now, I should have prepared you for this, but do you have like a 60-second or a 90-second passage that is really, really good that you can read an excerpt from your book or maybe something that's even on the back cover?
Yeah, I can come up with something if I have a second here.
Yes, take a second.
Really, what I would suggest people take away from the book, I'm gonna pass on that one, is to really understand that we're all caregivers in very similar ways, that yeah. Whatever the circumstances are, we have a lot in common with other caregivers, no matter what the issue is. And at the end of the day, it's all that we have deeply caring hearts and that we want to help those that we love. And sometimes we do it even though we may not like them so much. It's not always easy to care for someone and to love them no matter what. But we can do that. And first, we kind of have to love ourselves, which sometimes is even harder.
Yeah. Tell me about the people you interviewed. Where did you find them? What were you looking for when you were looking for people? Were they just random people, well, from all walks of life, or you narrowed it down to a certain category?
No, I tried to not to narrow it down to a certain category, but not to have it all be the same. I have people in the book that were caring for children, for caring for people with Alzheimer's and dementia and cancer, a couple different cancers, Crohn's disease, all kinds of things. And I really believe that, you know, the same, there's a lot of similarity between caregivers across all different kinds of issues that come up. So I reached out on social media, and I have a fairly good social media following. So when I connected with them and said, who do you know that's a caregiver? And I set up interviews, and I interviewed him on video so that I could really get really to the gist of it without making it feel like I was going to copy down everything they said. I really let people talk. And that was really interesting. And I'm sure that you find this too when you talk to caregivers. Some people just poured themselves out, and they needed somebody to tell this to.
They need to get it out.
Yeah, and it made them feel better, which made me feel better. So that was interesting in the process too.
That's why I recommend caregivers journal, you know, because that journaling might turn into a book. And, you know, a lot of caregivers have a book inside of them. It's like being pregnant, you know, and they're miserable. And it's like, you know, most pregnant women are miserable in their ninth month. And it's like, cause get this thing out of me. And I highly recommend caregivers to journal. And some people realize they have a gift of writing that maybe they didn't even know about. Once you start helping other people, it takes the focus off of you and your problems. It's not all about you anymore. It's all about, okay, I see I'm going through all this stuff. God is allowing this to happen, the pain and the suffering, so that I can help other people in pain and suffering. Even though no one was there for me, I had to figure it out myself and so on. So,
journaling is incredibly powerful. Being able to write down what you're thinking, and you're not writing it for someone to read necessarily, but just getting your thoughts out on paper, especially if you're feeling a little trapped and, you know, maybe you're in a situation where you're the primary caregiver in the home and you're just feeling like you got to get out of there and TV is not cutting it anymore, then you really can try journaling and just write whatever comes to your head. You don't have to journal about anything in particular. Just write. See what comes out.
And sometimes your loved one just frustrates you so much. And during that 2-year grieving period with my wife, I mean, it was 2 years of hell. And, you know, I just wasn't, you know, Charlene was angry and bitter most of the time. And at one point I just screamed out, I can't take this anymore, you know. So I sat down and I was going to write her a letter. I was going to tell her what is, you know. And I said, Charlene, why are you so mean to me, you know. I'm trying to be your husband, take care of you 24/7, and all I feel is nothing, no appreciation, no love, not even getting crumbs that I need. I says, I know it's hard on you. You're making it even harder on me. I just don't think I can be with you anymore. I mean, I'll take care of you financially, but I can't be with you. And I looked at that letter, and it felt better because I got it out, and I read it. I says, oh, my gosh, I can't give this to her. So I put it in my filing cabinet, and it's still there today, 22 years. And I read it every now and then, and I says, God, I was in a bad place. But you know what? I went to a support group, found out there were people just like me, found out that what I was feeling was not unusual. I found out that if I didn't take care of me, I couldn't take care of her. I had to put my oxygen mask on first. And so when I realized I was able to change, I just started being, quote unquote, selfish. You know, caregivers are so afraid to be selfish because that's a dirty word. But you know what? They are so far on the other side of the pendulum that being selfish would be good for them, you know, just to bring it back, not to be selfish, but to be balanced. And so I didn't give her the letter, and she started to change because I changed.
Yes.
And slowly, it took a couple of years. It seems to be the magic number for grief, 2 years.
I think so.
If it takes over 2 years, I know people who are still grieving after 5 years. And when I suggested to this particular person that they need to, like, you know, maybe move on in their life, she attacked me like a wild lion, saying, you don't know what I'm feeling, and everyone grieves in their own time, and blah, 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 blah. I says, ooh, sorry. So I'm very careful to tell people how long they should be grieving. But you know what? If you feel like you've been grieving too long and it's been 5 years and you're kind of tired but you don't know what to do, then I can help, you know. So again, we're back to the person who's receptive to help and the person who just likes feeling the pain and the pity party, that's what they call it. Is it pity potty or pity party? I always wondered. I think they both apply.
I think that the message there is that self-care is not selfish. Self-care is just plain taking care of yourself so that you can do better at being taking care of the person that you love. And if you don't take care of yourself, you're doing them a disservice. So self-care is never selfish, unless it's, you know, going and having your nails done while somebody's in a crisis. Well, then, okay.
See, folks, you heard it from the expert. So where can someone buy your book? And are you having any book signings or anything, you know, Barnes & Noble? Just let us know what we can do to help you make this book a success.
The book is available on Amazon. Right now it is in ebook and print. The audiobook's coming out next week.
Oh. And so are you reading it yourself?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
You know, I keep saying I've got to do that with my book, and it's just no time, but I got to make time.
It's so fun.
How long did it take you to read and record your book?
Well, the book is 3 hours, so it took me 3 days to really
do it. So you did just an hour a day?
Yeah, and then I found somebody to convert it for me to ACX, so it was ready for Audible. I had no idea how easy this is. I'm going to go back and do my other book because it was pretty straightforward. But people can find it on Amazon. They can also find information about it and some of the supplemental information on my website at janetfouts.com. And it's available in bookstores, though that's not shipping quite yet. So I'd stick with Amazon if you really want the
book. But you're doing pre-orders, all right?
Nope, it's out now.
Okay, good. Yeah. So, Janet, I understand you have a free offer?
Yes, I have a free ebook for any of your listeners who want it. And all they need to do is they can send me an email, or better yet, I'll send you a link that you can post and people can just click the link and download the book for free.
Awesome. Well, I can't believe how fast the time has gone. So you've given your contact information, your website again?
Yeah, janetfouts.com.
Okay, that's easy. And I am caregiverdave.com. And you, like I said, while you're there, learn about the benefits of joining our membership website and enjoy the value of being a member of our caring community. And for a limited time, I'm offering a free 60-minute coaching call to every new member on my radio show. You get to be on my radio show. So you may choose to be anonymous if you don't want your problems broadcast to the world. But you see, your story can help other people. And it's a rare opportunity for people who want to get their story out of them and help people at the same time. So I would say go to caregiverdave.com and check us out. So thank you again, Janet, and all my listeners out there. We will see you next time. So bye-bye.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Thanks again, and we'll see you guys next week, same time, same channel. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Caregivers Caregiver Radio Program with Dave Nassani.